Omaha Public Radio presents another program from Project Interfaith on Noon Forum. We'll hear a lecture given by the Reverend Richard Cizik, Vice President for Governmental Affairs of the National Association of Evangelicals. The topic of his talk will be A Warming of the Heart, Evangelicals and the Interfaith Movement. Reverend Cizik's appearance was co-sponsored by Project Interfaith, Grace University, and the Center for Faith Studies at Countryside Community Church. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, September 18, 2008, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Countryside Community Church, Project Interfaith, Grace University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is James Eckman, president of Grace University.
Reverend Richard Cizik is the Vice President for Governmental Affairs of the National Association of Evangelicals. His primary responsibilities include setting the NAE's policy direction on issues before Congress, the White House, the Supreme Court, as well as serving as national spokesman on issues of concern to evangelicals. One of the principal drafters of NAE's 1996 Statement of Conscience on Worldwide Religious Persecution, he's regularly called upon as an expert witness on creation care, human rights, religious freedom before professional groups such as Foreign Service Institute, the State Department's Advisory Committee on Religious Freedom abroad, and in meetings with officials of the National Security Council in the White House, the State Department, and Congress. In 1996, he served as professional staff to the Religious Leaders Delegation to the People's Republic of China at the invitation of then-President Clinton. In 2002, he was a participant in the Climate Forum 2002 at Oxford, England, which produced the Oxford Declaration on Global Warming, and was instrumental in the creation of the Evangelical Climate Initiative introduced in 2006. In 2005, the New York Times dubbed him as the Earthy Evangelist. That's a good title. I need to parse what that exactly means, Richard, but that's a good title, because he was an advocate on climate change. And then in 2008, perhaps many of you saw, as I did, he was on Time Magazine's list of Time 100 Most Influential People. He has successfully championed over a dozen legislative accomplishments through Congress and has been recognized by the New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof as one of the new internationalists. In the program, all of his credentials and degrees are listed. I would encourage you to look at those. But without further ado, let me introduce to you Reverend Richard Cizik. Would you welcome him? Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Good evening. Thank you. Now, I'm known for being a little loud. I'm also known for being a disturbance. In other words, a disturbance now and then is good, right? So if I get too loud, I think maybe I'm already a little too loud. Am I? Not so? Okay. Then I won't worry at all. So if I'm too much of a disturbance or too loud, you can always move out of the worship hall. How's that? Thank you, Cindy. Thank you, Beth. Thank you, John. Thank you all for coming out tonight. I'm really appreciative of it, and I hope you will leave rewarded, because I happen to believe that now is a defining moment in human history, and I happen to believe that if you don't act on what I'm going to tell you tonight, that your life will not be your life will be different than if you had. Do you hear what I said? I just said that today, what is occurring in this country and what is occurring around the world is a defining moment. And I'll explain what I mean by that on a number of different levels. But I also want to talk to you tonight about who these evangelicals are. Would any of you care to define yourself as one? You don't have to be afraid to do so. But I can tell you this. The definition of who we are and what we are about is changing, and it is evolving. And it is one of the biggest stories in American politics today. And so what happens to these evangelicals and what they think is going to influence, I would dare say, even who's elected president this fall. So look on this as a political instruction session, if nothing else. But I want to do that. I want to talk a little bit about the evangelicals, and I want to talk about why interfaith conversation is so important. So that's what I'm about. So let me start by telling you a story. Actually, I like political jokes. You like political jokes? Well, I have to explain to you, I'm one of those community organizers called a lobbyist. How could a community organizer be a bad person? After all, Jesus was a community organizer. But anyway, one of my favorite stories is of the politician. We've always had trouble with politicians, we evangelicals. Sometimes we really like them and go astray, and boy, we just sort of sign on for the whole kit and caboodle and find out afterwards, well, we maybe shouldn't have. But there were these Christians who had, you know, they were living and doing their thing, and there was this particular political leader who was into persecuting them. And all of a sudden, events turn, and he ended up himself in the lion's den. And he didn't know what to do. He did the only thing he had seen them do. He got down on his knees. I won't approximate that, although I think empathy is really important. He got down on his knees, raised his eyes to heaven, and beseeched, oh Lord, he said, please, Lord, make that lion a Christian. Well, about that point, a lightning bolt fell. The lion, just before reaching him, fell on his knees, in this case, clasped his paws in prayer, raising his eyes to heaven, and as you can well imagine, he said, bless the Lord, this food of the use in us, thy service. Bless. So you have to be careful what you pray for. Second story. I've told this one. It was in Villa Graziola. It's just a little ways outside of Rome. And I was with some Christian people and some Jewish rabbis meeting with the advisors to a well-known nation in that part of the world that is near Afghanistan and, Iraq, and you can sort of figure it out. But anyway, it was one of these countries that has a leader who's coming, as he is in a few weeks, to Washington and New York again. I guess just New York again. The people that put on say, I just can't mention his name, but sounds something like Ahmadinejad. But anyway, he has these advisors, and we were all meeting together. There's Jews, Christians, and Muslims, and the story was told. This story was told among the three different groups, and it bears repeating because it goes like this. And now you can substitute your own faith group if you can put in a United Church of Christ. I'll put evangelical. If you're Muslim or Jew, you can put that in. But anyway, in this case, an American evangelical is driving in his Jeep Cherokee over hill and dale. He slams on the brakes. He walks out over to the shepherd who's quietly tending his flock, and he says, sir, if I can tell you how many sheep you have, can I have one? The shepherd's totally dumbstruck. He doesn't know what to think of this guy doing this, coming into his world as he was. And he said, well, sure. So the American evangelical goes over, gets into his Jeep, gets onto his laptop, goes to GPS, I call that God's positioning satellite. And with a matter of moments, he's come out with a ream of papers like this, and he goes to the shepherd and he says, you have 1,638 sheep. And the shepherd said, that's just amazing. How did you do that? Go pick one out. He does, and he's leaving, and the shepherd runs up to the window of his truck and knocks on. He says, sir, if I can tell you what you do for a living, can I have my sheep back? And the American says, yes. Whereupon the shepherd says, you are a consultant. And the American says, how did you know? The shepherd says, well, it's pretty simple. You come into my world about which you know nothing. You answer questions I've not asked, leave out to charge me a lot of money. He says, you don't know diddly squat. Lastly, he said, you took my sheep dog. Well, the rabbis laughed, the ayatollahs and the others laughed, and so did the Christians. Because in that particular instance, what we were doing was trying to explain ourselves to the others, to the other. And it's quite apparent in this country that We don't do that. In fact, we can live amongst each other and it never happens. And so Ellison Research out of Phoenix, Arizona, released a poll this week on American evangelicals that has said number around 100 million in America, one out of three almost, if not more. That's if you count women, children, dogs, and all those who have already died and left the roles of the church years and years ago. You know, people do that, you know. They never take the people off the rolls. The Southern Baptist Convention did a search and found that there weren't 16 million, there were really only 6 million. But anyway, even so, what the survey showed was that despite these evangelicals, one quarter of the adult population, 50% of those surveyed could identify something, but not much about who these people are, and the other 50 could label nothing. They couldn't describe anything. For the foggiest, they couldn't name one identity trait. Now, among the 50% who could identify something about these evangelicals, 44% said they were strict Catholics. And a high percentage of them, of these people who surveyed about themselves, the evangelicals, said that they believed in angels. I can only attribute that to Billy Graham's book on angels. And some said, well, they are followers of Jesus. Imagine that. You know, some people got it right. But among the 50% who got it right, there was no cohort that got more than 10%. Isn't that amazing? Well, I would like to say to you, as a representative of the, well, they called me and asked me for the definition in this report that aired all around the country this last week, and I told them this. Evangelicals are people who are, one, firmly committed to the Scriptures as the Word of God and believe in the infallible and inerrant Word in the original autographs. In the original, some gentleman down here is following me, in the original autographs. So that doesn't mean, for example, that the, you know, the common versions today that you find, whether it's the American Standard or the New International Version or any other version, is necessarily inspired. But in the original autographs, we evangelicals believe they were inspired and the Word of God, and it is the sole authority in matters of faith and practice. So if you are a Catholic and you give authority to the Pope, that doesn't entitle you to, in my definition, call yourself an evangelical. But nonetheless, it's considering the Scriptures as authoritative in faith and practice. Number two, having had a born again experience. Now, that is sometimes interpreted by the evangelicals in our community as someone who's had that sort of walk the sawdust trail up and, like at a Billy Graham crusade, commit your life to Jesus Christ and have a conversion experience. And it's that sudden Damascus Road Apostle Paul kind of experience that people, often evangelicals, interpret associated with the evangelicals. But having grown up in a mainline Protestant church, I can tell you that these evangelicals include people such as myself who, yes, have had, I say, a born-again experience, but it was also an experience that gradually evolved in a sense that I had training and instruction as a child. And so there came a point in my life where, yes, I said, God, I have to tell you, I'm messing things up, and so I'm going to commit my life to following Jesus. And that was when I had this warm, as Wesley expressed it, this warm feeling in my heart. So that's the born-again experience. And the third part of this is sharing your faith with others in a variety of ways. That's how evangelicalism is defined. It's my definition. Obviously, it's not the only definition, and there is no perfect definition. But the question is, I think for purposes tonight, what is happening in American religion, and how are these evangelicals playing a part in it? And I want to say to you that this is a defining moment, and those evangelicals are helping change that conversation about what's happening in America and what's really important. Okay, so I think this is a defining moment in human history for the following reason. There is a great shift in energy occurring on the face of this earth, and scientists, systems analysts, climatologists and others say it as follows. 230,000 years ago, man learned to control and use fire. That was one of those defining moments. Man used to learn to control and use fire to warm his body and heat his food, stave off disease, and that was a defining moment. They also say a defining moment was 200 years ago when man begin to burn not just organic materials, but you see, burn coal that powered the steam that produced the Industrial Revolution, that increased our standard of living like never before in human history, and that was the second. And now they are saying we're at one of those moments in history today in which, because energy is going to necessarily have to shift, the forms of energy we are using is going to have to shift, will make this one of those defining moments in human history. And the reason that's significant for you and me is because the same climatologists say that if you don't change the way you think, you will be a loser. And if you change the way you think, they say you will win. And it will affect every organization. It will affect every person, and it will affect even the church. And that's really hard for some people to accept. But what I'm saying to you is that climate change is happening. It is human-induced. It is producing effects around the world which are very, very serious and will change the world forever. And if you can't change the way you think about that issue, you potentially put yourself in the position of all of those around the world, what Christian Aid says are 1 billion people who will actually either be negatively be impacted or lose their lives on account of climate change. And that makes this one of the most defining issues of our time. Now, I say that I want you to leave tonight with a vision different on that issue and then one other issue. It's how we relate to our fellow human beings and people of other faiths. That's why this is an event about interfaith dialogue and conversation. Yes, conservation too. So let's call it conservation and conversation tonight. But have you ever heard the story when it comes to this vision, responsibility? Have you ever heard it said by the man who said, well, he turned to his wife and he said, sweetheart, he said, I don't have very good hand-eye coordination, and I can't see very well, but he said, thank God I can still drive. And if we don't have a vision for change, I'm going to tell you that we're going to be among the losers, not just spiritually, but otherwise too. Now, I want to give you a vision, I want to give you a strategy, and I want to give you tactics. I'm sorry for that, I'm a lobbyist in Washington. But that's how I have worked, by outlining a vision. And what we have to have is a revisioning of how we see the earth. And traditionally, Christians have ignored this issue. And you have to ask yourself, well, why? I do. The leaders of Earth Day movement in 1970 and thereafter said there were never any preachers involved in the movement. Why were there never? Because it was not perceived as a religious issue. That is stewardship and care for the earth. It was a secular issue. And so historically this has happened because we have become, I would say, Neoplatonists. And by that I mean we're followers not of Jesus but of Plato. And what do I mean by that? How can it be, you see, that we are followers really of Plato? And what I'm saying is that Plato said ideas are important, matter is important, and from the early times of the church, while I'm not saying the early church fathers were heretics, I'm saying that many of them substituted a concern for matter, this earth, for the spiritual, so that today we live in two kingdoms. Many of the people in our churches live in two kingdoms. One is the kingdom that is mine and ours, that which is mine, and one is a kingdom, that which is God's. And these two kingdoms operate side by side, and we live in this bifurcated world. Well, the reformers in the 16th and 17th century, they didn't help us much either, because what they said, this is Calvin and Luther and others, they said the real contest is for your soul between God and man, and the earth is just, the earth, you see, is just a platform, a stool for that great contest over your soul. And it doesn't matter that much either. And then in recent years, you see New Age philosophies and others have substituted the scriptural teaching on this matter. In fact, a teaching that comes from all of the religious traditions, that the earth has to be cared for and protected. But it has not been found. Let me tell you the story to illustrate it. I have been to the northwest of the United States, schools like Whitworth College, all the way to the east side with Harvard, Princeton, and Yale, and as far south into Florida, like Stetson into Land, and Hardin-Simmons in Abilene, and everywhere in between. Take Lee University, 30 miles from where the Scopes Monkey Trial was held in Tennessee. 4,500 students in chapel, and I have asked them, did any one of you ever get a single sermon on this subject and not a single hand was raised? And it's pretty much the same at every one of the universities. And so I would like to get at what is the problem by asking you questions such as the following. What is your paradigm for the future? Is it the eternality of the soul or the resurrection of the body? Now, not everyone here, of course, is Christian. Of course, I understand that. But other faith traditions have a heaven and a hell and a resurrection as well, right? But so I have asked you and I have asked others, what is your vision for the future? And almost without exception, the Christian people have said their vision is for the eternality of the soul, not the resurrection of the body. And why is that important? Because if you do not believe as a Christian in the resurrection of the body, there is no faith that you really have if you follow Jesus, because you have to believe in your heart. You see that God raised him from the dead and you will be saved is the scriptural teaching. But you see, most people answer that question in the eternality of the soul. And what Christianity teaches is that there is no future for a disembodied soul. But that's what most people think. Most people have in their heads a disembodied soul. I have to ask you, what is your vision? And if it's for a future forever, eternity, as a disembodied soul, I'm telling you, that is not what Christianity teaches. And why it becomes important is because if you separate, you see, our bodies from the earth, and then there is no need for the earth. In fact, I meet millions of Christians through one way or another, through their spokesman or otherwise, who believe this earth doesn't matter. It's all going to be burned up. And that isn't either a scriptural teaching either, because it will be a new heaven and a new earth. And that's why this issue, I believe, a stewardship is one of those defining issues of our day. There's one other issue, and I'll illustrate it this way. The event was at National Cathedral, and I was ushered in by the appropriate officials at the cathedral in Washington, D.C., for an event on September 13th of 2001. You can already guess what it was. It was the National Service for Remembrance for the Victims of 9/11, and the speaker that day was George W. Bush. And I was ushered not into the main alcove of National Cathedral, but to one of the side sections. And I was occasioned to sit beside two people, Jim Dobson and Jerry Falwell. And when I sat down, I heard discussion of gays and lesbians and other issues which secularists and the rest... and it made absolutely no sense to me. But nonetheless, I just kept my mouth shut, sat there. But at one point, Jim Dobson turned around to me and he said, "Hello, Richard." I said, "How are you?" I call him Jim. And he said, right away, he said, "You know, this was an attack against us." I said, "I didn't view it that way." He said, "It is an attack against, you mean us Christians?" He said, "Yes." I said, "I didn't see it that way. I saw it as an attack against the West, a way of life, and a lot of other factors, but I didn't view it primarily as an attack against us." Well, the man sitting right next to me, this went on back and forth, was reading Martin Luther. And I asked him, what are your thoughts on this? He turned out to be a Lutheran minister, and he said, "Well, regardless of what was in the mind of Osama bin Laden," of course, we didn't know at the time it was Osama bin Laden, "but in the minds of the attacker, regardless of what was in his mind, we don't respond as Christians." Well, on that one, we could both agree. It's the responsibility of the government to respond, not us. A number of years later, I heard Jerry Falwell, the late Jerry Falwell, as I have others in my community, like Franklin Graham, refer to Islam as an evil and wicked religion. I heard Jim Dobson refer, you see, to Islam as a religion that has 50 million adherents who want to kill us. You see, that kind of language is what has circulated in my movement. And so the second issue that I really do believe and want to say to you today is a defining issue, is this issue of how we relate religiously, both here in this country and abroad. Because if we don't fix this one, I don't believe we're going to fix a lot of other issues. They're very related, but it is that important, how we talk to one another and relate to one another. Now, here is a vision, you see, a vision that says we're in this together, we have to protect this earth, and we have to learn to live with one another. And I believe it not only comes from the scriptures, but it comes from the best of our traditions, religiously speaking, together, regardless of whether we're Catholic, Protestant, Jew, Muslim, or whatever. And I happen to think that we have to learn to live and to adapt to change. Now, what is this about? Thomas Berry, the historian, said it's the great work of a people. That's what he called it, the great work of a people. And if we don't do it, he said, our lives will never be the same. Now, how then, I would ask, might we do this together? How might, if this is the vision to live together, then how might we do it? I believe that the answer is found in Robert Putnam's admonition to bridge outward, to get beyond our comfort zone. And if that is what I think is a strategy, it's what I have employed, and I would recommend it to you as follows. Let me say a couple of things. We're in a church. UCC church? Could as easily be an evangelical church. And Abram was given a charge. It was in Genesis 12:3. And God said to you, God said to Abram, I want you to leave Ur of the Chaldees, and I want you to go and leave your land. But if you leave and go to this new place, I will give you land, I will give you children, and your posterity will be as great as the stars in the sky. And yet there was a kicker to this promise in Genesis 12:3. It was that if you are a blessing to others, I will continue to bless you, and if you aren't, I'll take the blessing away. That's how I understand the verse. There are others in my community who say that the verse means that that was a promise solely to the Jews and to Israel. Those you bless, I will bless. Those curse, I will curse. You may know this. But I happen to believe this was the promise given to the church. And I happen to believe if the church doesn't act this way, the promise, the blessing will be taken away. Does that make any sense to you? Let me say that I am a lobbyist, and I work inside Washington, and I have been given a vision that's associated with a document for the health of the nation, and it says that for we as evangelicals today, our responsibility is not just on a couple of different issues, same-sex marriage and abortion, but we're to be responsible for religious freedom, sanctity of life, care for the poor, human rights, creation care, and peacemaking, and these are all of our principles. And if I am interested in advocating for those principles, the question is, how do I do that? Here is how I have chosen to do it in the context of bridging outward, as Robert Putnam describes it. I have gone to Tibetan Buddhists to pass the International Religious Freedom Act, which is called the IRFA Bill, which established an ambassador-level post in the State Department to address religious freedom issues. In other words, bridging outward beyond my comfort zone to go to Buddhists and of others and others of different faiths to pass the IRFA bill, which is now law, by the way. It's the first time in American foreign policy religion has actually been put into American foreign policy. To gays and lesbians to pass the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, PEPFAR, reaching beyond, you see, a strategy that heretofore in this country has been a zero-sum game when I, to win, have to make sure others lose, to a strategy that we're going to pursue the common good. That is bridging outward. It says, if there are millions of children who are trafficked into sexual slavery around the world, then why shouldn't I go to feminists like Gloria Steinem to help pass a Trafficking Victims Protection Act, or the apolitical Koreans to pass the North Korea Human Rights Act? It's called bridging outward, and that, I believe, is a strategy that we have to employ on all of these issues. And if we don't, I don't see how we get beyond what is the culture war and identity politics. Now, I just had a chat with the Omaha reporter on these issues, and he asked, well, what are the options? And I said, well, the options are we pursue a common good strategy that brings us together as Americans to address these issues, right? A common good strategy. Or we fall back into identity politics and the culture war issues. And he asked, well, what would you say is the consequence of, say, going back to the religious right and the culture wars and identity politics? And I said, well, I think the consequence of it is that we will have an extremely polarized electorate. I happen to think that what happens if you adopt a strategy, you see, that says somebody else has to lose for me to win, as opposed to pursuing a common good strategy where everybody wins, the consequence is that, now listen to me, you are suspicious of authority, number one. Number two, you diminutionize, is that a word? In other words, you reduce the value of experience. And lastly, in other words, you say authority isn't important. Authority, you question authority. You say experience doesn't matter. And ignorance, lastly, is strength. Ignorance becomes strength. Does this strike you as having happened recently? Do I need to say more? I take from your reaction, I don't need to say more. Lastly, I would like to say that if you want to do this business of reaching out to other people, you can't have a vision and a strategy unless you have some tactics. Now, you'll pardon me if I go to an Old Testament illustration lastly, but here's what's occurring in our country today. I'll illustrate it as follows. In the 6th and 7th century B.C., King Darius, you can go to Daniel chapter 9, was constructing the Medo-Persian Empire. And he, in attempting to bring together the Medes and the Persians, you know who the Persians are, don't you? Contemporary Iranians. In attempting to bring them, there's a laugh. The Medes and the Persians together, King Darius confronts a circumstance as follows. His young advisor by the name of Daniel, who has apparently by virtue of his wisdom made his fellow advisors jealous, becomes the victim not just of a coup against himself, but against King Darius as well. And what is it? What is that coup? The satraps go to King Darius and they say, O king, write a decree that no one would pray to anyone save you. And he signs the decree. And then the satraps, you see, come to Darius and say, sir, they say, Daniel is over in his window praying. And so if Darius had exonerated, let Daniel off the hook, he would have essentially denied his divinity, which was the case of the king in that time. And so a coup is planned against King Darius. And it goes like this. He must either choose to save his friend, Daniel. Follow with me? You with me? You can choose to either save your friend, Daniel, and give up the kingdom, or save the kingdom and sacrifice your friend. And so what does Darius do? Darius goes, after a whole night of struggling over this issue, he goes and he says, "May your God whom you serve save you." And he throws Daniel into the lion's den. And in the next morning, when Daniel comes out of the lion's den, Darius says, "Oh, may your God live forever." And Daniel says, "Oh, king, you live forever." But the choice that Darius, you see, was confronted with is the choice that political leaders around the world today face. And it's the question of either to save their friend and sacrifice the kingdom, or save the kingdom and sacrifice their friends. And I would like to say, in this country, we have political leaders, you see, who are willing to sacrifice not just the kingdom, they're willing to sacrifice the planet because of their friends. Do you not understand what I'm saying? Because, you see, there are huge interests that go to political leaders and say, this is what I expect you to do. And so they make this choice, in effect, I'm saying to you, to save their friends in these respective interests at the expense of the planet. And you want to know the current illustration of it? The Climate Security Act, which is aimed to address this issue of climate change, was defeated in a cloture vote about a month ago on straight party lines in a party line vote. And what I'm saying to you is that if that doesn't illustrate more than anything else the power of interest groups in Washington, I don't know what will. Now, we really do have to be people who understand, I believe, what's occurring in Washington, what's happening, and reach out to other people in order to do this together. And the biggest change which occurs on this issue today is between evangelicals, mainline Protestants, Jews and Muslims and others to begin to address these issues. And I happen to believe that's the only way we'll begin to address these issues. That's the only way I believe we can actually, in fact, meet the challenges of a planet that's in peril. Now, I'm reminded of one last story. Can I do that? I know I'm probably over. Not over in time. But I want to say, what is leadership? Leadership is moving people from where they are to where they ought to be. And we frankly can't do this in this country without each one of us playing that kind of a role. And so the question is, will we? Will we together facilitate the way, moving from the way things are to the way things ought to be? One of my favorite stories in going around to campuses is going as it was to Ole Miss. And I don't know if you know this story, but in 1962, a student decided to, against, you see, the threats of violence from the mob, you see, against the political establishment of his day, he decided, with the help of others, of course, to be the first to integrate Ole Miss. And today he's memorialized in a statue standing a bit like this at the entrance to Ole Miss. And over the archway above the bronze statue of James Meredith is imprinted one word. It's imprinted courage. And I frankly think that to reach across the aisle, to collaborate with people, to do what we're talking about, requires courage. And that's what I would leave you with. The great Wesleyan, John Wesley, put it this way. He said, "To serve the present age, my calling to fulfill. Oh, may it all my powers engage to do my master's will. Arm me with jealous care as in thy sight to live. And oh, thy servant lead, prepare a strict account to give." We give accounts in a lot of ways. We give accounts to politicians when we vote, and we'll do so this fall on November 4. We also have another account to give, and it's the account ultimately to, you see, God. And I happen to believe, whatever our religious tradition, if we don't do this, then I believe we'll have an account to give that is not, "Well done, thy good and faithful servant." I ask you to join me. I've asked political leaders from around the world to do this. Do you know the name of C.S. Lewis? You know, do you know the name of Clive Staples Lewis? He writes the story of Screwtape, of three young devils who were completing their training in hell. And immediately before their dispatch to earth, they appeared before the chief devil for their instructions. And turning to the first of the three, the chief devil asked the following question. He said, "What will you tell them when you go to earth?" And he answered, "I shall tell them there is no God." And the first devil replied. And the chief devil said, "Well, that's not much use. He said, "They've already been told that many times before. And many of them know him personally." To the second devil, he turned and said, "What would you tell them? What would you tell them?" And he said, The second devil said, I shall tell them there is no hell." And the chief devil said, "But that, unfortunately, won't work either. Many of them are already living it." Finally, he asked the third, "What will you say?" And the third young devil in training, mind you, this is C.S. Lewis's writing, he answers, "I shall tell them there is no hurry." "Excellent," exclaimed the chief devil. He said, "Go up immediately and get to work. Tell them there is no hurry." I happen to believe we're in a big hurry. I did an interview once with Christiane Amanpour for purposes of CNN special called God's Warriors. And she said, "I'm going to Lynchburg next." And I said, "Ah, you're going to meet Jerry." Meaning Jerry Falwell. And she said, "That I am." And I said, "You should go quickly. He has congestive heart failure." And she said, "No, I don't know that." I said, "He does. You should go quickly. And besides, if you can get him to say climate change and evangelical in the same sentence, I'd really appreciate it." And if you get him to say Rich Cizik, that would even be better. But I'll keep my ego in check. She went that weekend, 2 days later, to Lynchburg, Virginia. She met with Jerry, and among other things, Jerry was recorded on the television saying the following. He said, "I asked Hezekiah for 20 more years." And that was on tape. "I asked the Lord for 20 more years." Well, it was the weekend I flew to Seattle, and I got off a plane. And I had a text message from the BBC that said, "Falwell, dead." And I called them and I said, "I can't believe that." They said, "He preached on Sunday and went to his office on Monday and had a heart attack. And because no one was there, he died. There was no emergency rescue team, no one to call the doctors. He died of a heart attack." It was the same Hezekiah in the Old Testament, 2 Kings 20:19, you can look it up, who said, when told that the Jews would be taken into exile, "Well," he said, "at least I can live in peace during my reign." Because he said, in the future, they will be taken into exile. And Hezekiah said, "Well, at least I can live in peace. In other words, what an incredible failure of leadership, a failure to see the future. And so, by the way, on that subject, don't quote me, but Jerry thought he had 20 more years, and he had a few days. We don't know. We really don't know how much time we have. And so I really think it's important, the urgency with which we deal with these issues and deal with them together. So I thank you for coming, and I hope I've offered you something to think about.
Mentioned a false belief by someone else. We won't go into it now anyhow, that 50 million of the Muslims want to kill us. And you said that was very inaccurate. On a percentage basis, what would you estimate? How many of them?
I think Jerry, or I think in this case it was a Jim, had done some miscalculation on his part. What percentage are Islamists and Wahhabists? I don't know.
That would like to kill us.
I don't know.
What would you guess? 50%, 10%, you know, just... I know you don't know.
I don't know.
But a guess.
My experience, let me put it this way, is... throughout the Middle East and meeting with leaders, is that it's a fraction. I tell you why. I'll give you one illustration. Some of the bombers in Baghdad, including a number of women who have strapped bombs to their waists, and those who blew up trains in Madrid, came from homes in Morocco. Now, I know Morocco. I've traveled there frequently. In fact, the king of Morocco, King Mohammed VI, has given me help to fly out into the Sahara in order to see the consequences of desertification. And so in Morocco, if you take it, for example, what percentages are willing to kill others? Probably 0.1% or less. Now, Morocco is not, you know, Afghanistan or even Pakistan. It would be friendly and is friendly to the United States, so it may not reflect the whole. But nonetheless, isn't it interesting that those that have done this have come from, at least some of the high-profile bombings have come from a country that actually was not part of the Ottoman Empire? So I can't answer that question, but I do know this, that it would be unwise to assume there are those who don't, and it would be unwise to assume they all do. They say about China, and I've traveled throughout China, they say something is true somewhere, but nothing is true everywhere. So you must be careful about stereotyping. I recently flew to Denver about 2 weeks ago to meet with Muslim leaders because I'm one of the few evangelicals in the United States who will do this. respectfully. By the way, you want my tips for doing this? Let me give you three. It applies across the board. I was writing them down before coming in here. Motivate. Don't always just advocate. And what I mean by that is most people have a built-in desire. Most people do in this country a built-in desire to make America a better place. But we have to be careful, especially guys like me, not to want to impose my agenda on them. And so, like I said, because the harder you push, a lot of harder back others push. In other words, the harder you push, the harder they push back. It's really wise to be winsome and non-argumentative, so motivate, don't advocate. Secondly, show some empathy and compassion. If you want to build interfaith relations, my experience in working is accept people as they are And acceptance does not mean concurrence or consent. So empathy is compassion. And lastly, I say, try to listen appreciatively to what everyone has to say with reflective listening. And so when I go overseas, and in an attempt, you see, not to be the ugly American, I try to listen appreciatively. And I sometimes, in order to understand what somebody else is saying, I paraphrase what they've said in an attempt to understand it. And then I give appreciative summary statements. And so, to give you an illustration, I have been introduced to the Islamist parties, for example, in the Middle East, the Islamist parties. And one of the things I say to them, I say, jokingly, we have something in common, you and I. And that is that we both take our religion very seriously and that I respect you for that. And so that's the lastly, just a little bit on making that communication better. Yes.
What do you think about the importance of war and violence? Because those seem to me to be paramount to anything else, including climate change.
A well-known scholar, theologian in the 1980s speculated two threats, one to the biosphere, the second through nuclear weapons. I believe that war and violence are equal threats, but I tell you what I do worry about more than simply war and violence. I worry about the threat of nuclear terrorism. And the reason I do is because I've heard from some of the best in the world who say it's real. And I heard it recently in the home of former Secretary of State George Shultz, because the two of us had invited evangelical leaders to meet together to discuss this subject. And this is what William Perry said, former Secretary of Defense for Bill Clinton. He said, the detonation of a nuclear device in an American city is not a question of whether, it is a question of when. And his view is shared by four men, three others, Henry Kissinger, George Shultz, in whose home we were seated, and Sam Nunn, two Republicans and two Democrats, Perry and Nunn being the Democrats, Shultz and Kissinger being the Republicans. And the leaders that I had with me were stunned that he would say this. Now, this is why they together have authored a program and a proposal called Global Zero to eliminate nuclear weapons, with a staged process. This is not utopianism. And they are not, you see, anything but realists, if you know Henry Kissinger and company. They are realists, not utopians. But they have a staged process for doing it because of the following reason. In Ronald Reagan's day, well, let me put it personally, when I wrote a letter to Ronald Reagan advising him to give a speech that became the Evil Empire speech in 1983 to the National Association of Evangelicals, then the assumption called mutual assured destruction was that possession equaled non-use. If you follow what I'm saying, mutual assured destruction, possession meant non-use. Today, these four secretaries of state say that possession and the existence with non-state actors in the role as terrorists means use. Possession equals use, which in their minds necessitates global zero and the ultimate elimination of nuclear weapons. And I have joined with them, signed a statement. The first meeting is in December in Paris, and a national campaign on Global Zero will then commence. But you asked me. So I happen to agree with John Stott in 83, who made that prediction, that those are the two biggest issues facing mankind. One, the threat to the biosphere itself, and secondly, the threat as it is today of not just nuclear war, but nuclear terrorism. So that's how I see it. And I happen to think that contrary to the stereotype of evangelicals that we have, the evangelicals will become not only the leaders on climate change, but also the leaders in this movement in this century that may take 50 years. This is what the authors suggest. It may take longer, but nonetheless, they believe it's important, and so do I. But that's not most people's stereotype of evangelical.
Let's thank Reverend Cizik for a wonderful talk.
You've been listening to a lecture from Countryside Community Church on Noon Forum. We've heard a lecture by the Reverend Richard Cizik, Vice President for Governmental Affairs of the National Association of Evangelicals. The topic of his talk was A Warming of the Heart, Evangelicals and the Interfaith Movement. Reverend Cizik's appearance was co-sponsored by Project Interfaith, Grace University, and the Center for Faith Studies at Countryside Community Church. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, September 18, 2008, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Kugler, Director of the Center for Faith Studies at Countryside Community Church, and Beth Katz of Project Interfaith for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Coate, thanking you for listening.